Okay, great. Well, I guess we'll go ahead and start. So thanks everyone for coming out. I was kind of wasn't quite sure how many people were going to want to come out to hear someone talk for an hour about a bunch of defunct technologies. So I appreciate everyone showing up. Kind of feels like the equivalent of going to like the Consumer Electronics Show and giving a presentation on Laserdiscs and 8-tracks or something. So anyway, but so I guess, you know, just to set this up a little bit, I thought it might be worth talking a little bit about why I think anyone should care. So for the next hour, I'm going to talk about a lot of early precursors to the web, a bunch of different versions of hypertext, and a bunch of early sort of thinking that went on around how networked information systems could work. And the reason I think that's interesting is not just because I think it's historically interesting. I actually think it's potentially very relevant to what's going on the web today. And I think if you look at the history of technology, you know, it's pretty clear that the best technology doesn't always win. In fact, the best technology usually doesn't win. And we can look to, you know, just on a lot of our, you know, sitting right in front of us right now, look at the example of Windows. You know, when Windows first sort of rose to prominence, there were a number of other operating systems that were, you know, by any technical standard, far more advanced. You know, the Mac OS, there was, you know, OS 2, there was, you know, early versions of Unix. I mean, by any sort of reasonable objective standard, Windows was not the most sophisticated thing out there, but it's become dominant. You could also look, for example, at you know, the history of videotapes, where you had VHS and Betamax, and Betamax was certainly a superior technology that failed in the marketplace for reasons that really had very little to do with the technology itself. And you know, I think the same argument can actually be made about the web, even though, you know, for most of us, the web has become this just pervasive fact. In a lot of ways, you know, it's a very simplistic technology, which is actually why it's become so successful, as it's kind of a lowest common denominator kind of platform. But if we go back and look at some of the technologies that led up to it, I think there's some very interesting lessons we can learn about, you know, just other ways of thinking about interactive media and ways of networking information together. And you know, and so in this presentation, I'm basically just going to kind of walk through, you know, some examples from these early technologies, and then try to relate them to some of the current limitations that I think we're running up against with the web. So as I started to kind of research this topic, I went looking for kind of the earliest example I could find of somebody describing something that looked like the web. And I ended up having to go quite a ways back. I was a little surprised that the first, let's see if this will work, there we go. First example of somebody writing about something that sounds a lot like the web was all the way back in 1883. And this is a guy named Charles Cutter, who I imagine probably very few people have ever heard of. He was a notable librarian back in the 19th century. He was actually a contemporary of Melville Dewey, who invented the Dewey Decimal System. And Cutter, you could actually argue that the Dewey Decimal System is kind of the Windows of library catalogs. It's Charles Cutter actually had a much better library catalog system that failed to gain traction in the marketplace, although it is actually used in the Library of Congress and some big research libraries. It's a much more sophisticated way of organizing books. So Cutter, and Cutter was actually a big thinker about, you know, information and ways of creating, you know, information spaces and metadata and things like that. Although they didn't have the word metadata then. But anyway, I'm just gonna put this down a little bit. In 1883, he wrote an essay for Library Journal called the Buffalo Public Library of 1983, where he was trying to imagine what a library might look like in 100 years. And he had this, and this is 1883, so they barely had a telegraph then. The first patent for a typewriter had been filed just a few years before this. And but he had this idea that, you know, someday you might have some kind of device sitting at a desk with a, you know, keyboard attached to it, connected by a little wire. And the idea he had was that people could type things into that keyboard and they'd be able to pull up a book that might be stored somewhere else. And that over time, all of these little, you know, devices could be networked together in some way, and yet you could have books being accessible from all kinds of different places without having to have people physically go and retrieve a book off a shelf. So for 1883, that was pretty good. Of course, this was all just theoretical at this point, but this, as far as I can tell, was the first sort of glimpse of something that kind of sounds like the internet that I was able to find. A few years later, H.G. Wells, who I'm sure most of you have heard of, is, you know, a famous science fiction writer, wrote an essay that was quite influential at the time called The World Brain. And in this essay, he describes a vision for the way electronic information might take shape. I mean, this was in the early days of radio. There was just glimpses of something like TV starting to emerge. And he began to have this idea that over time, this sort of emerging electronic infrastructure would enable people to create new kinds of documents and to access them in new ways. And he had this idea that the whole thing would become what he actually called an encyclopedia, which was interesting. And he had this idea that over time, a vast network of information would emerge from people collectively contributing information to this vast sort of data warehouse. And that eventually he went a little bit further. I mean, he was a science fiction writer after all. He had this idea that that whole kind of vast network would somehow kind of come to life in some way or acquire some kind of intelligence. It was a little bit of an out there idea. But his essay was quite influential. It inspired a number of people who I'll talk about later who started to think about this idea and think about what would that look like, if you could actually take information and network it together in some way. And keep in mind, this is an era where there was no such thing as a microchip. There was really no such thing as a screen or again, this was still very much in kind of a very analog sort of mind. But he was he was starting to have a glimpse of where this might be headed. A few years later, there was another guy named Teilhard de Chardin, who was a French Jesuit monk or priest, I guess, who had a kind of similar idea, and he started to write these essays where he talked about, this was a few years later, and radio was really starting to take hold, and TV was kind of out there, and he started to look at this and also sort of saw this emerging possibility of some new kind of network information space kind of emerging out of the ether as people started to collect and share information. Interestingly, de Chardin's writing was considered quite controversial. The Catholic Church actually banned him from publishing because they thought it was kind of heretical, and it was sort of considered a threat to the Orthodox view of the Catholic Church. And he went a little bit further and talked about how basically people would be able to sort of approach some sort of divine consciousness by basically sharing information over something like the web. So he was considered a bit of a heretic, but he nonetheless acquired a pretty loyal following among a number of other Jesuits who actually started to circulate his papers privately just through sort of an informal network, and he would just send them around to friends and they would circulate, and he developed a real cult following within the Catholic Church and eventually outside it. One of his fellow Jesuits who became fascinated with his vision was a guy named Marshall McLuhan, who basically took de Chardin's work as the foundation for his whole vision of the global village. And McLuhan later acknowledged that de Chardin was kind of the starting point for a lot of his theories. So these were just some of the early glimpses of something like, an internet. But again, all of this was very theoretical. I mean, none of these people were really trying to build anything. They were just sort of imagining kind of visions of how things might work someday. But there was another guy around this time named Paul Otley. And Otley worked around he started work around the turn of the century, and in the early part of the 20th century, he did a lot of deep thinking about information and ways of collecting and organizing information. And Otley was kind of a fascinating figure. He was kind of a librarian, although he probably wouldn't have quite called himself that. He's founded a movement that was known as documentalism, which was about kind of the theory of information. And he wrote prolifically, about his whole theory about how information could be organized. And his sort of core insight was that he felt like librarians sort of had it wrong, that they were fixated on the idea of books, of basically finding ways to let people get to individual books. But Otley's insight was that there was a lot of information that was kind of trapped inside those books. And if you could sort of get beyond the physical artifact of the book to actually sort of penetrate the covers of the book and unearth the information that was inside, you could then kind of remix that information in interesting ways and basically create new kinds of documents or new kinds of interfaces, you could say, to sorting that information and classifying it. And he thought that over time you might have whole new kinds of documents or experiences could arise out of that if you could just find a way to get the information out of the books and into some more open framework. So this is a... Oops. This is a little diagram. All these books, very little of his work has actually been translated into English. It's mostly in French, but his books have these great little diagrams, and this one sort of, I think, does a pretty good job of articulating his vision. So his basic idea is, just going from the bottom up, was that you might have some kind of classification system that would enable you to organize information that would be stored on index cards, which was kind of the state-of-the-art storage media of the day, which could, and the information on those cards would be basically extracted from books. And then those books, of course, are filled with ideas, which come from people who apparently have like Lucky Charms popping out of their heads or something. But it's sort of, I think this communicates vision very well, is that the book is really just one layer of information, and he was really taking a much bigger, had a much bigger vision about just looking at that whole continuum of how information gets produced and circulated and thinking about new ways and new forms of working with that information. This is another diagram that talks about sort of the mechanics of how the system would work. So the important thing about LA is he was not just a theoretician. He actually wanted to build this. And he actually did build it. He got funding from the Belgian government to basically pursue this vision. And he built an institution called the Mundaneum. And this was in the 1930s. And this was during the time when the League of Nations was really starting to emerge. And it was headquartered in Brussels. And this was part of he was able to sell the project by sort of tying it to this vision of this utopian idea of kind of a world, a world peace, and the idea that there could be sort of a way of sharing information globally and having a sort of single storehouse of the world's knowledge that would all be classified and easily accessible. So he got the Belgian government gave him actually some prime real estate to actually build this thing, and he went and he hired a bunch of people, and he actually went through this process of taking, you know, tens of thousands of books and having people go through and sift through those books to extract information and to file that information on index cards. So you can see he's got kind of an army of people out there actually doing this, going through and, you know, collecting facts and sort of putting them down on cards and then filing them in this system that he developed. It's called the Universal Decimal Classification. He had a whole framework for how that would work. I'm going to talk a little bit more later. So it was a pretty interesting idea. It was fairly sophisticated for how to actually make that information easily accessible and reusable. So this is another snapshot of it. So there was a documentary that was made about Outlay a few years ago. And I'm just going to show you a quick little excerpt from that, and we'll hope the audio works. Let's see.
1934, Outlay publishes his most important book, The Treatise on Documentation, The Book on the Book. This is where we find the most visionary pages, where already the concept of the computer emerges.
Here, the workspace is no longer cluttered with any books. In their place, a screen and a telephone within reach. Over there, in an immense edifice, are all the books and information. From there, the page to be read, in order to know the answer to the question asked by telephone, is made to appear on the screen. A screen could be divided in half, by four, or even by ten, if multiple texts and documents had to be consulted simultaneously. There would be a loudspeaker if the image had to be complemented by oral data, and this improvement could continue to the point of automating the call for on-screen data. Cinema, phonographs, radio, television, these instruments taken as substitutes for the book will in fact become the new book. The most powerful works for the diffusion of human thought. This will be the radiated library and the televised book.
So this was 1934, right? So pretty good. So why has no one heard of Outlay, right? Well, the reason for that is, as I mentioned, he did all of his work in Brussels. Well, we all know what happened to Belgium in 1938, 9, I think. The Nazis came marching in. And they promptly took over the Mundaneum. They gutted it. They threw everything away. They basically tore the place apart and made room for an exhibition of Third Reich art. And Outlay died penniless and pretty much in obscurity a few years later and was basically forgotten for like 30 years. Obviously, you know, in the years after the war, Belgians had other things on their mind, trying to rebuild their country, and somehow his whole legacy was just more or less forgotten. Until about 25 or 30 years later, There was a young grad student, young library science grad student named Boyd Rayward, who somehow uncovered sort of the paper trail of the Mundaneum, and he made a pilgrimage to Belgium to look for sort of the remnants of Otley's work, and he found Otley's office basically more or less had been untouched in that whole period. And it was, he walked in, there were cobwebs everywhere, this cluttered desk with papers everywhere, and he found all of Otley's papers and manuscripts and the whole like plans for this thing. And Otley, Rayward, wrote an article about him, eventually wrote a book, and slowly Otley has started to kind of resurrect his reputation. A few years ago, they actually they've actually rebuilt the Mundaneum as kind of a museum to Otley's legacy. But it's interesting, is he clearly, you know, pretty much thought up the idea for the web basically in 1934. But in the post-war period, you know, most of the history of computing technology has really been driven by sort of the Anglo-American industrial complex, and the heritage that we tend to look to are people like Vannevar Bush and you know, sort of people who were writing in English and working within the, you know, the framework of, and the internet itself came out of, you know, the National Science, came out of the Defense Department basically. So there's been a significant sort of bias towards sort of a U.S. kind of you know, Anglo point of view on the history of technology, but I think this is a pretty compelling case to be made that Otley kind of thought of it first. So these are just some, a little more, I want to go into a little more depth, not too much detail about how the whole thing worked. So this is sort of a scheme that explains how the classification system worked. And just to summarize at a very sort of high level how it worked, the idea was that you had, what was I think very interesting about it, in a way more sophisticated than the way the web works today, is that Otley had this idea that you could have kind of a top-down classification of knowledge that would be sort of determined, you know, by librarians more or less, but that you also could have a very bottom-up sort of user-driven way of classifying information, and that those things could actually coexist and complement each other in some way. So in his classification, there's actually a framework for capturing relationships between documents that users would suggest. He had this idea of what he called the social space of a document, the idea that you could never really understand a book by itself, but you can really only understand a book in relation to other books and to the people who read it. And his classification system actually attempted to capture all that information and make that part of the record of the, you know, of the document. He also had this idea, which I think is also quite relevant to the web today, that those links between documents could actually mean something. So if you think of the web today, it's a very, you know, hyperlink is kind of a dumb thing. Basically, you know, this page links to this page, but it doesn't really tell you anything about, you know, what that means, right? Like a link is a link is a link. But in Otley's world, the idea was that you could actually say this document agrees with this document, or this document disagrees with this document, or there are other sort of gradations of meaning there, so that the links themselves could actually become, could communicate something that could then be part of that larger sort of paper trail. So it's a pretty, in a way, a fairly sophisticated idea, even though, you know, the entire thing ran on paper, right? There was no, like, you know, no electronic aspect to this at all, other than the fact they did, I think they accepted queries via telegraph. So people could actually telegraph in a query and pay a small fee, and then the you know, the people on staff would then go look up the answer and telegraph it back to them. And it was actually profitable. He actually made money doing that. So kind of a very, you know, manual version of Google, I guess. Anyway, so I think it's interesting to think about. Okay, well, what if things had been different, right? What if things had turned out otherwise? And what if, you know, Otley's web had become more of a kind of foundation of, you know, what the web turned out to be? Well, I think for one thing, you would have more of a sort of top-down layer. I mean, the web is obviously a completely bottom-up sort of thing right now, which is, you know, I'm not saying that's good or bad, it's just the way it is. But I think it would be interesting to imagine a world where you had some sort of you know, sort of ontology or some way of organizing that information at the top level that then could coexist with more of a bottom-up sort of social classification, and to think about how that could play out. And this idea of links that actually contain some meaning, I think, is also a pretty interesting idea. So it's interesting to look around the web today, and there are examples of people who are starting to kind of approach some of these kinds of ideas. This is a demo that I saw a year ago at a conference called Facet Tag, I think it's pronounced. Face Tag, I don't know, I'm not quite sure how they pronounce it, but it was developed by, the idea is it uses what's called faceted classification, so I think it might be Facet Tag, but, and it was developed by some guys in Italy, and what they basically developed is a way of experiment in sort of merging a top-down classification with a bottom-up classification. So the idea is that users can basically come up with links, and that all these different links on the web could be described in terms of a kind of set vocabulary of terms. So you could have the type of resource, you could have the people that are mentioned, the function of it, the topical themes. So there's some sort of high-level framework, but the contents of the classification is actually driven by users. So it doesn't predetermine, what possible categories are within this framework. Users actually do that, but then as people go through the process of actually tagging things or classifying them, those tags are then exposed and suggested. So if you start actually tagging something, other tags are suggested, and then it fits into kind of a larger space that can be sort of sorted and filtered. So it's an interesting sort of attempt at a compromise between a top-down and a bottom-up sort of classification. Another example is this is called a facet map. It was developed by a guy named Travis Wilson, I think. And this is an example using wine and the idea of trying to let people create a faceted classification for describing different types of wine, which is a fairly rich kind of information space. You think about it, you've got regions and varietals and prices and and so forth. Interesting, and if you set up sort of a framework for doing that, you can then look at interesting ways of sort of, mixing and sorting and filtering that kind of data rather than having kind of a simplistic sort of top-down hierarchy. And another example I think worth mentioning is this is a proposal that's floating around, and I don't actually know where this stands in terms of the W3C, but it's an interesting proposal to create a framework for what they're suggesting be called vote links. And the idea is that you could have a simple addition to the href tag that would enable you to describe in very simple terms what a link means, that it agrees or disagrees with something. There might be some other variations on that. But it's at least an acknowledgement that there's an opportunity to do something more with the hyperlink to make that actually encode some kind of meaning rather than just have it be kind of a one-way street the way it is now. So that's Otley. So I think it's interesting to look at some of these ideas, but certainly Otley was not the only one to think about something like the web. The person who tends to get more of the credit, and deservedly so, is Bush. Now, the two things I've learned about Bush since I started researching this, one is his name is actually pronounced Vannevar, and second, he is no relation to the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Happy to report. Bush was a major figure in the post-World War II scientific establishment. He was an advisor to FDR. He was a prolific inventor in his own right. He invented all kinds of interesting tabulating devices and microfilm readers and ran his own lab and was incredibly prolific. He was later became the president of the Carnegie Institution and held a lot of other very high-level posts. He was a real key figure in the era of the Manhattan Project, in the whole U.S., the whole science establishment that was emerging at the time. But today, most of those accomplishments have been forgotten. The thing he's mainly remembered for is writing a little essay that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly in 1945 called As We May Think. And he actually wrote this essay in 1939 before the war, but then held off publishing it because there were other things going on. So, and then it was reprinted in Life magazine a few years later and was quite popular. So in this essay, he proposed this idea of a device he called a memex. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of this. But the basic idea is that he saw this as a tool that would let, he intended it more or less for scholars. And the idea was that users could sit down at a desk and they could pull up a document on a screen. And those documents were stored on microfilm, which was the only thing. Again, this is all still pre-digital era. But the idea was that you could pull up a document on one screen, and then you could pull up another document on another screen next to it. And you could actually relate those documents to each other. And so he coined a term for how that would work. He called it a link. Right? So he thought, a user could sit down and link one document to another. And in doing that, they could also make some comments about that relationship and actually contribute to a store of information that would also get recorded. And so the idea is that the user sitting at the desk would actually basically take two documents, mix them together, and add something to it. And then that would then become part of the permanent record that then another user could come along later and actually see that trail. So the idea is if one person sat down and thought this document relates to this one, somebody else coming in, a week later would see that somebody thought that document, that there was that link and follow those trails. And those trails would build up over time and be kind of browsable in some way. there's a little more to it than that. He also, the people using this were supposed to have like a little camera attached to their forehead and some crazy little things like that. So he wrote this essay describing how the thing would work. And I won't read this to you, but I just put a couple of excerpts here. The key idea was that, Bush's big insight was that, scholars are involved in creating levels of meaning that aren't necessarily captured in the experience of reading. And that if you could actually capture some implicit information about that whole process of doing research, that would be hugely valuable to people, to be able to expose those links and those trails and let people see them. And he saw that over time, that would lead to some fundamentally new kind of document would emerge out of that, which he also called an encyclopedia. And that people would be able to create these kind of these meshes, as he called them, of associative trails, and then they would be portable. You could put them in another Memex and then create things on top of them. So that's the basic idea. So I think it's a couple things to point out about the Memex. One, even though Bush was a very accomplished inventor, he actually had no intention of building this thing. It was a piece of vaporware from the start. And that was very much on purpose, because Bush saw he'd actually tried to build something like this and had been totally frustrated because the technology didn't quite work the way he envisioned. The microfilm was still at a fairly early stage. A lot of the things he was trying to do, there was no easy technique. And he tried to build it and failed, and then he said, all right, I'm just going to drop it, and I'm going to describe the thing that I'd like it to be, and I'm going to draw a picture of that, and then maybe someday somebody will build it. But the whole point of it is it was kind of a concept car. And interestingly, it's, I think ironic that that's the thing that Bush is best remembered for. Even though he was an incredible inventor, most of his inventions have been forgotten, but this is the thing that has lasted. So again, it's interesting to look at, so even though Bush is actually kind of credited as kind of like the forebearer of the web, in some ways his vision was actually more sophisticated, even though it was running on microfilm. I think the key things that Bush's Memex would have had that the web doesn't have are links that work in both directions. So if you're looking at a page on the web and it links to another page, you get to that other page, there's no record of where you came from. I mean, there may be in your browser, but there's no sort of public record of that. So Bush's idea was that you could pull up a document and not only see where it links out to, but what links into it, right? And that he felt that was a critical kind of feature. And this idea that the trails could be made visible in some way, that one user's experience could become part of a larger record, I think is also kind of a key idea that the web just doesn't really support, at least not well. But that said, there are people out there who I think are trying to approximate some of these features. Because of these kind of basic shortcomings of the web, people are kind of hacking their way around or looking for ways of doing some of these things. I think one obvious example of that is trackbacks, where it's at least an attempt to show inbound links to a particular document, right? It doesn't, we all know it doesn't work that well. It's, it's all kinds of, spam trap problems. But in principle, that's the idea, right? That there's some value in seeing, inbound links to a document. I think another example that's worth looking at in terms of sort of exposing users' trails through a path of documents, I think Delicious and other sort of social bookmarking sites are a great example of people seeing that it's interesting to see what other people are reading and to follow those trails, even though I think Delicious is kind of a very simplistic implementation of it because it's basically just a list of bookmarks, but you can sort of create the experience of looking through those trails in different ways. So it's at least an attempt to sort of get at some of this kind of functionality. So I'll talk more about Bush a little bit later, but another person I want to mention is a guy named Eugene Garfield. And Garfield's an interesting guy. He was actually inspired by reading Bush's essay to rethink the way people would organize scientific information. So what Garfield came up with was, he was also kind of a librarian. He certainly was an information scientist anyway. And he came up with this idea that he was very interested in the way people organized like scientific journal articles and things like that, and monographs and that sort of thing. And he felt like most of the ways that most indexes to that kind of information were very limited, because basically it involved somebody manually going through and reading an article and deciding what it was about. But he felt that actually a better way of doing that would be to actually look at who's citing this article, right? So in some sense, he didn't actually care about the subject matter. What he cared about was looking at the footnotes. And he thought if you followed sort of the footnote trail, you would see kind of the web of influence that a particular article might have. So you could see this article got cited in all these different places, and then He also then would look at, okay, who's citing this article and how often have they been cited? And so he would give them basically a kind of ranking based on, you know, this article has a high rank, and therefore if it points to this document, that means more than if this other document that's not cited at all gets a lower rank. And he came up with an algorithm, I guess you could say, for measuring that. So does this sound familiar? It's basically the same idea that Google uses to basically rank articles, you know, to rank links. So these are just a few examples. This is some of his early. He wrote quite a bit about this whole theory and wrote. I'm going this very lightly. It's a pretty complex sort of system, but it works really well. It's Science Citation Index is considered, if you go to most science libraries, it's like it's the most indispensable book in most science libraries now. It's hugely expensive, but it's a core kind of research resource for scientists trying to do secondary research on journal articles. And now it's sort of migrating online. So if we think about what Garfield's web would look like, that's actually pretty simple. In fact, when Sergey Brin and Larry Page published their paper about the Google PageRank algorithm, Eugene Garfield was the first source they cited. There we go, we're back. Slide it up, yeah. Is that good? Hello? Am I still on? I guess so. It's on, okay, sorry about that. Anyway. Right. Okay, so moving on. The next person I want to talk about is a guy named Doug Engelbart. And Engelbart was actually a disciple of Bush. He was stationed in the Navy in the late 40s, I guess, right after World War II. And he got a copy of Life magazine and read Bush's article, and he says it basically changed his life. And he decided, this is what I want to do with my life, is try to realize this vision that Bush had. So once he got out of the Navy, he started to basically pursue this, and he became an early pioneer in computer science. He's today actually best known as the inventor of the mouse, but in a way that's kind of like the least of his accomplishments. I mean, that's obviously counts for something, but what he spent most of his time working on, the mouse was actually developed as just a supporting tool for a much bigger vision he had, which is what he called the online system. And he worked at Stanford Research Institute throughout the 60s and 70s on this vision. And what he created was basically a system for organizing networked information and sharing it within a group. His work was actually funded by the Defense Department. Part and parcel of the whole project that I think ultimately led to the internet. And he wrote He wrote a long paper about this called Augmenting Human Intelligence, where he described this whole vision. And in 1968, he gave a demo in San Francisco that's since been called the mother of all demos. And it was this, he unveiled the system for the public to see. And these are just a few slides from the demo. I love these kind of 60s looking people with their jet planes and leisure suits. The basic idea was a little bit, the thing to understand about his vision is he really saw the system as a way to support groups of people working together. Whereas Bush's idea was a little more focused on the individual, he saw that there was an opportunity to create tools and a kind of like an operating system where people could work together to create and collaborate on documents and share information with each other. So I'm going to try to show just a brief excerpt from that demo. And this is, unfortunately, I couldn't download a version of it. So, oops, we're going to see if this works. Let's see, just click on it here. Okay. This is very grainy, so you have to bear with me a little bit. We'll see how the network does. Give me a second.
This tool. In pursuing those goals, one of our principal tools is this computer aid system. Let's talk about it as a system. There's a link sequence to jump in there too. What we talk about, NLS, in the online system, a very general term. It's going to be NLS for many, many years, an online system that will evolve. Right now, we consider it to be primarily an instrument and a vehicle for helping humans to operate within the domain of complex information structures. Well, what do we mean by operate? Well, compose, study, modify is the place we started now. We know there are many other analytic things you could do, but we want to get around, study, and modify. And then to further information about what does complex structure mean, we're talking about complex structure and emphasizing structure because we say, although the content represents your concepts, there's a structural relationship between that content entities that should represent the relationship between the concepts of human thought. All right, we never can do that very well with linear text. So inside the computer, we can represent that quite well. In fact, we can represent information structures in a computer that would generally be far too complex for you to study directly. But NLS serves as a tool to roam over that, navigate through a complex structure, be able to find your way and be navigating, move about it rapidly, and be able to see what you want to see at any given point. That's how we think of NLS as a tool. All right, these are all very important concepts to us because these, together with bootstrapping, have told us where to start. We start by building an instrument that we can sit at and work during our day to organize the kind of working information we need as a task force developing systems. We need to write our specifications, our plans, our programs, our users' guides, our documentation, our reports, and even our proposals. So we've been using these. Let me return back here.
Okay. So that gives you at least a little snapshot. The whole demo is about an hour and a half long. It's actually all up on YouTube, and I would encourage anyone to check it out. It's fascinating. There's a lot more to it than this. He talks about he's got like a live video conferencing application built in. He built a whole word processor. I mean, it's a pretty elaborate system that was incredibly farsighted. So again, it's interesting to look at, okay, what would things have looked like if Engelbart's vision had really come to fruition? Well, again, he was very focused on enabling small groups to collaborate. You know, this idea of what he called process hierarchy. So the idea is you could have sort of embedded kinds of functionality that would let people kind of create layers of meaning on top of things. It's kind of a complex idea, not quite doing justice. And then you have these built-in sort of multimedia tools. So one shortcoming of the web today, I think, is it doesn't support collaboration very well. And even I saw Tim Berners-Lee give a talk a few years ago, and even he acknowledged that was one fundamental shortcoming of the web is it's really designed for an individual user. And it doesn't really do a particularly good job of letting you collaborate with people, at least within the web browser. And I think Engelbart's idea would have been much more to support kind of collaboration between people and to let the browser be a little more of a two-way street. So as a result, we have people kind of finding workarounds and trying to sort of approach some of these kind of functions. So I think wikis are a great example of that, of creating kind of a collaborative space on the web. I think you could also look at sort of groupware applications that are out there. It's just one example, but all those kind of collab. And none of these tools really work all that well because the browser is fundamentally so limited. It doesn't really support identity management, and it doesn't really have a lot of the things you really want to make something like this work. So what we have are a lot of solutions that are kind of halfway realized because they have to work within the very strict limitations of what you can do in a web browser. This is another pretty interesting example, which is hard to kind of demonstrate unless I really pulled it up. But the idea is that actually in recent years, Engelbart has tried to create kind of a tool working with some collaborators has tried to create an approximation of NLS in a web browser. And this is actually a thing called Hyperscope that was kind of an experiment in trying to embed some of these functions. So the idea is it's a very hyperlinked kind of document that opens and closes and collapses, and you can share information with other people and sort of collaborate within it. It's a pretty interesting idea, but it's very beta, but it's an interesting thing to look at. So Engelbart, certainly I think has become a incredibly important figure in the history of computing. A lot of his early collaborators went on to found Xerox PARC, and there they basically invented the personal computer, Ethernet, laser printing. I mean, these are sort of Engelbart's proteges who went on and had this incredible influence. So Engelbart's still around and still working. He's in his 80s now, but he's still around and still active. I think certainly he has a vision that in some ways is far beyond what the web has really turned out to be. So I want to talk about a couple more people quickly. And one, I do want to spend some time on Ted Nelson, who I think, well, if it wasn't for Ted Nelson, probably none of us would be in this room right now. Ted Nelson is cited by Tim Berners-Lee as the inspiration for the World Wide Web. Nelson himself is a interesting figure. I actually gave a talk a few months ago at Google that they put on YouTube where I referred to Nelson as half crazy, and I got an email from Ted Nelson a few weeks later, so taking exception to that, so I won't say that, but not at all. So I'll just say that Nelson is sometimes characterized as half crazy. he is at the same time an absolutely brilliant guy, and you know, a formative figure in this whole thing. I mean, he deserves all the credit in the world. He's known to be a bit of an eccentric, but he is a real, I think, kind of inspiring figure in that he basically has spent his entire career working outside of the computer industry. Up until like the last few years maybe, but most of his sort of important work was done really on the fringes of respectability. He started as a grad student in sociology at Harvard, and he'd had a background as a filmmaker and was a real kind of humanist, but he started hanging out in the computer lab a little bit and working with some scientists and mathematicians, and he felt that he was fascinated by the potential of computers, but he felt like they had it all wrong. He thought that basically they were treating computers as calculating machines, and he thought that computers could be a lot more than that, and he also felt like there was kind of a tendency among sort of so-called computer scientists to kind of control access to the computers, that they were building kind of what he called a priesthood of, you know, a class of computer professionals that was kind of locking out a lot of other people who might be able to benefit from these things. And so he spent his most of his career kind of railing against that and promoting a very different vision of what he called a very humanist vision of computing, where computers would really be, that anybody should be able to use them, and that the real potential was to give people tools for individual expression, to empower people, to kind of liberate them, and to let people connect with each other directly without kind of the filter of sort of institutional controls and that sort of thing. So he was a bit of a fringe figure for a long time. He self-published his books. He wrote an extremely influential essay in 1965, I think, where he coined the term hypertext. And I'll talk about that a little more in a minute. But he went on to write a series of books that he self-published, and they've got this real kind of revolutionary sort of vibe to them. I mean, they're kind of ranting. They've got all kinds of crazy pictures in them, and he sort of goes off on, you know, against, you know, the IBMs of the world and, you know, the whole sort of industrial computing complex. And he's got these, you know, like, these great like images, you know. So this is around the time of, this is like the early 70s, so around the time of like Women's Lib and, you know, Black Liberation Movement. He's like Computer Lib, you know, Power to the People. He writes books like this, and Dream Machines is another one. And then if you're going to read one book by Ted Nelson, I would say this is probably the one to read, Literary Machines, which is kind of a successor to Dream Machines, where he talks about his own vision, his own sort of concept car, the system he calls Xanadu. And his idea of Xanadu comes from the poem about Kublai Khan, this kind of mythical ideal play, utopian place. And his idea is that this is basically his idea for what became the web, this idea of this open collaborative space where people could create and share information in new ways. This is a drawing by Andy Van Dam that sort of talked about Nelson's vision. He coined this great little phrase, everything is deeply intertwined. So his books are full of these great diagrams where he really just explains this whole idea of hypertext, which nobody had thought of in this way. You know, just a completely different way of thinking about documents and the way they can work together. And it gets way out there. I mean, some of the stuff is just really hard to penetrate or understand, but it's pretty. I mean, some of it is really hard to make sense of, and some of it is just incredibly insightful. This is how we defined the term hypertext in 1965. And this was really just a whole new idea at this point. I mean, nobody really could quite get their heads around this for a long time. And if you read those documents, he has this incredible genius for just making up words, which I won't try to go through all these, but I love terms like, you know, in window sandwiches, you know, Humber's thinker toys. I'll talk about a couple of them though, briefly. Transclusion, I think, is an important idea. It's the idea that you could have a document that embeds information from another document in kind of real time. So rather than what we have today, which is just hyperlink, you know, this document links to this document over here, and maybe it's still online, maybe it's not, you know. Nelson's idea was that you could actually take a piece of that document and put it inside another document, and that it would be a live connection. So if this document got updated, this other, it would be updated in both places simultaneously. Some of these other ideas, he talks about hyperbooks, fresh hyperbooks, and what he called anthological hyperbooks. The idea is that you could have, rather than kind of a one-size-fits-all kind of document metaphor, you could have very different types of experiences for different kinds of information. So you might have fresh kind of original information, and then you might have new kinds of documents that kind of collect or aggregate that information together, and that those things might look and behave very differently. So some really deep thinking in here. I mean, he thought really long and hard about issues like intellectual property, you know, copyright controls, you know, identity management, things like that. I mean, it's really deep, but again, stuff is kind of hard to read, but it's worth making the effort. So what would Nelson's web look like? Well, it actually wouldn't necessarily look like the World Wide Web. So I mentioned transclusion. He also thought it was critical that links work in both directions, as in Bush's sort of idea. Again, he did a lot of thinking about how to protect intellectual property on the web. And these are just some examples of people trying to kind of approximate Nelson's vision. This is an example of transclusion. Actually, this is a better example. The idea that you could have these documents that are updating each other, you know, in real time. And this is an interesting little prototype called an experimental browser built by a guy named Brad Newberg, who's actually at Google now. And the idea is that it's a web browser that supports things like transclusion. It is much more of a collaborative tool where users can basically interact with the documents and with each other in a way that's hard to do in a web browser today. So again, it was kind of an alpha kind of prototype experiment, but it was a pretty interesting attempt at kind of rethinking the web browser in a way that could still work on the web. So a few people have sort of skirted around the edges of this kind of question, but nobody's quite sort of realized what Nelson had in mind, and it's not clear if anyone ever will. So what does Nelson think of the web? Well, not much. You could say this is sour grapes, but I think he has some fair points here. I mean, in a way, he basically says, you know, the web is basically the most simplistic thing you could imagine, and there's some truth to that. Which is also why it's been so wildly successful, because it's the lowest common denominator kind of solution. But in Nelson's vision, it's really, you know, we have a long way to go to really get anywhere near what he had in mind in terms of, you know, how a hypertext world could really work. So I want to leave some time for questions, but I'll just talk quickly about a couple other folks. Andries van Dam was actually one of Nelson's early collaborators. They worked together in the late 60s to actually build the first version of a working hypertext system. This was at Brown. And they built this thing called the hypertext editing system. And it was basically, you know, ran on kind of green screen terminals, but they used it actually as an experiment in classrooms to let students sort of collaborate with each other and publish information and share it and network it together in interesting ways. They were building this right about the time that Doug Engelbart was inventing the mouse, so they didn't have any kind of pointing device. So instead what they had was a light pen and a foot pedal. You felt like a point and kick kind of interface, you know. And over time, this system evolved through the 70s and eventually into the 80s. A new system was developed called Intermedia that was much more sophisticated. They built this in kind of a lab environment. And it was an attempt to, in a somewhat controlled environment, create a sort of hypermedia learning environment. So the idea was that they had a lot of tools sort of built into the desktop for doing things like, you know, multimedia authoring, for you know, letting students like write papers and then create links to original source materials and then create kind of like meta views of that information. It was a pretty interesting experiment. It was obviously running in a very kind of in a walled garden, but it was some really interesting learning came out of that. And in a way, it was also more sophisticated than the web. They had the idea of applications, you know, network functionality that was really embedded in the operating system, so you didn't have a kind of a one-size-fits-all browser. Instead, you had very special-purpose tools like a multimedia editor, you know, a networked word processor, you know, and all kinds of different tools that were particular to the kind of media you were working with. And the networked functionality was just built into everything. So you didn't have this idea that you had to open up a web browser. The whole, you know, computer was kind of your browser in a way. They also had two-way hyperlinks, which is a kind of a critical, you know, key feature of their system. But again, it was kind of a closed system, which is how they were able to you know, realize that kind of vision. It would have been very difficult to do this in kind of an open framework, but it was certainly a pretty interesting experiment. A couple of them I'm just going to mention very briefly. I mentioned Xerox PARC being founded by some of Engelbart's early collaborators. They built a thing called note cards. It was also a very early attempt at kind of hypermedia, where they had a very different sort of model. Instead of like web pages, they had a metaphor of cards. And then with you had, the idea is that you had information on a card that could link out to other cards, and then you had kind of nodes of information that would take shape around that. So you would have different ways of browsing that information. So this is another screenshot. So you had, they also coined a term, there was like a browser or browser card that you could use to look at other cards. And then a file box, kind of a storage area where you could file things. So it's interesting. I haven't actually seen this, so it's hard. I mean, I'm sort of just communicating what I've kind of read about it, but it seems like another interesting precursor to a web-like environment. Another one that's I feel like I should mention, although I have yet to find a screenshot of it, at CMU, they were doing a project called Zog around this time. It was also another hypermedia application, but I haven't been able to find examples of it. I don't know that much about it, but it's certainly, I think, definitely from what I've read, worth mentioning. And then the other one, of course, worth mentioning is Apple HyperCard, right? Which I'm sure some of you saw was sort of being in the 80s and 90s. It was also, you know, somewhat more limited, but a way of having kind of hypertext-like experiences within a, you know, to create hypertext-like documents. So that brings us up to Tim Berners-Lee, who I probably don't need to say too much about. I will just briefly show an example. This is one of his early desktops, and then on the corner there is actually a photo of the next machine where he actually invented the web. I was actually at a conference. They had this on display at the Louvre in Paris a few years ago. And that's what it looked like at some point early on, you know, in the HTML 1.0 era. So just to kind of summarize this a little bit, you know, if we look at these different systems, what are some of the themes that kind of emerge? Well, I think one is this idea of you know, having a different kind of classification where you could have kind of a top-down layer and a bottom-up layer working together. The idea of links that work both ways, being able to see people's pathways through documents, links that might mean something. I think the idea of identity and reputation is very important in a lot of these systems, and having a more stable framework for managing identity and giving people, you know, sort of controls around things like privacy and intellectual property around that. And the idea of treating users, I think if I had to characterize the whole, you know, in very general terms, most of these early systems really treat users as creators, right? Whereas in some way, the web, I think, tends to treat people as consumers. Just the basic framework of how web browsers work is they're tools for consuming information. And to the extent that we create things, we have to go to other websites or invoke sort of tools to do that. But the browser itself doesn't really let us do that in a particularly useful way. So if we think in general, like, okay, so what is that, you know, what does that sort of point to in terms of what a sort of next generation might look like? I think, you know, actually something like Facebook attempts to do a lot of this kind of stuff. If you think about it, you've got, and I know we're all probably sick of hearing about Facebook by now, you know, the idea is it does have a way of managing your identity. It has, you know, links that actually have different shades of meaning to them. Links do work in both directions. And there are, you know, a lot of these kinds of features that are sort of missing in the web. I think one key to Facebook being so popular is it does provide a framework for a lot of these kinds of features. And I'm not saying Facebook is the all end all of anything, but I think it's very interesting to look at it and sort of through the filter of some of these early systems to think about, you know, why does it seem to resonate so much? I think it's because it provides a solution to a lot of these fundamental shortcomings of the web. And I really don't particularly want to single it out. It's just one example that comes to mind. I think other people are certainly sort of heading in this direction too. But I think it is interesting to look at, you know, just how some of the web shortcomings have actually enabled, created I think, a very fruitful environment for people to go after some of these shortcomings with developing new web applications. So finally, I just thought I'll leave this up for a minute. If anyone's interested in looking further into this, these are a few resources I would recommend. And I'll just leave this up for a minute. I've got like 4 minutes, so why don't I just open it up and see if anyone has any questions. I think we're going to try to use the mic. Sorry. Guess because we're podcasting this, so.
Do you have an article that you're writing on this?
The question was, do I have an article that I'm writing about this? So I'll answer that question briefly with a quick plug for my book. So I'll save that for the end. But yes, I wrote a whole book about, well, this and other things. But this is everything I've talked about is basically one chapter in the book, right? I look at sort of the history of information systems and how they've evolved over time. And I'm not going to plug this to death, but if anyone's interested, I will be doing it at 3 p.m. this afternoon. I'm doing a book signing in the, it's in the trade show. They have a book booth there, so I'll be there at 3 if anyone's interested in taking a look at it or talking to me more. So
I'm always fascinated when there's sort of competing technologies, the sort of Darwinian nature of the battling technologies, that a lot of it seems to come down to simplicity versus complexity, and simplicity seems to win out a lot. Do you think that's the reason why the web, with all its shortcomings, is it the lowest common denominator is actually what you want because there's more chance that you're going to succeed because of simple?
I think you're right. I think it's absolutely the reason that it succeeded is because it is so simple and because, you know, basically anybody can put up a web page pretty much. I mean, that is the key to its success. So I'm not necessarily advocating or saying that these systems are necessarily more desirable. I mean, I think the web is, I mean, the web's great. I mean, that's how I make my living, you know. But I do think it's, it could be a little more, I think, you know, it could still be easy to use and open with having a, you know, while still addressing some of these issues. But I think, unfortunately, it seems like browser development has essentially come to a grinding halt, you know, and nobody, it seems like there's such a kind of a de facto sort of monopoly in place around this, you know, the kind of dominant browsers that it's, you know, you don't really see a lot of effort, people really pushing it or trying to address these issues.
Yep. Hey, Alex. So a question that I have is just on the education side of information architecture, and it seems as though the history is really based around the library system, and I'm just curious, for somebody to get really started with IA, would it be better to be studying to become a librarian, or is there a more specialized degree for IA? Is there a blur that's occurring there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I studied library science in a previous life, and it was a long time ago. It was kind of before, you know, 1994, 95, and at the time there really wasn't much kind of web education going on then. My own sort of background has been slightly relevant to what I do, but I think that's starting to change. I think I know in Berkeley the old library school is now the School of Information. They actually merged their HCI program with their library school, and it's called the iSchool or the SIMS, School of Information Management or something. You're starting to see that, I think, in a few places. I think Kent State now has an information architecture program. So there are definitely a lot of library schools are teaching IA, but I think you can come at it from sort of two angles. There's the sort of, you know, library school angle. There's also sort of the design track, you know, and those things come together in some way, and I don't think anyone's quite figure that out yet, but I think we are starting to see at least some movement towards a more sort of a formal education path for information architectures. So I guess we'll take, oh, sure, I'm sorry. Yeah. I guess we'll probably make this the last question. So.
I have a question about how you imagine the infrastructure for this potential next generation evolved web, specifically with respect to ownership. Like, Do you see that it's feasible to build out something that kind of either adds to the web or creates some kind of replacement? I don't know if replacement's the right word, but is that something that can happen through a private / commercial context, or do you see some potential of public ownership or collective?
That's a really good question. The honest answer is I don't know, but I think. I think it's going to take some combination of operating systems evolving and, you know, the browser vendors and you know, companies like, you know, Google, Facebook really trying to think through, you know, how can we create a better infrastructure at the, you know, at the client layer. And that's not, I think the big problem is that the web is so, there's just such a mass of legacy content now, you can't just start over. Like, we have to kind of build on top of that. I think the, you know, there are frameworks like the W3C. I mean, there are frameworks for moving things forward, but it's very, it's a messy problem. I mean, I don't really know what the answer is, but I think certainly it seems like there's enough demand in the marketplace to address some of these issues that I would hope that over time, these some of these kinds of features will start getting more embedded, you know, in the client level, so we won't necessarily have to rely on going to websites to deal with these things. But I don't claim to really have any kind of crystal ball into how that'll happen. So anyway, great. So I guess that's it. So thanks, Alan.